All right, welcome. Welcome to the May, what is it, 18th House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. As is the custom, we start on Thursdays with something about veterans, but uncustomarily today, instead of talking about the passing of a veteran, I want to talk about something that is a reminder, just as important. We were in committee, Senator. How are you? See you.
So nice to see you.
Hello. Good to see you. Welcome. We start the committee with something having to do with why we're here. Most of the time on Thursdays, we talk about the passing of a military member. But today, in honor of Armed Forces Day, and the fact that President Truman in 1949-1950 established that, it was an opportunity to think about the other role we have, not just in taking care of those who have fought and served, but also to ensure that the things that we do on their behalf, the equipment that we purchase, the support we provide, is actually aligned and the right stuff for the right time at the right price. In March of 1941, many people may not know this, but many I'm sure do, President Truman at the time was a senator. Senator Truman was given the opportunity to form the Senate Special Committee to investigate the National Defense Program. And he used his time in the Senate to ensure that every dollar spent, every scarce dollar spent on national defense was spent well, so that when we were at war, people weren't taking advantage of the fact that we were at war. And I want to emphasize that because a story was made available to me today that I think is worthy of our attention. U.S. Navy Rear Admiral was sentenced recently for over two decades. This particular fellow rose to the ranks, Navy ranks, eventually achieving the rank of Rear Admiral. Along the way, he earned several honors, including the Bronze Star, Purple Heart for his service in Iraq in 07. However, also along his career path, he met and evidently decided to hang out with Malaysian business person Leonard Glenn Francis. Some of you might have read the stories. He had many nicknames, one of which was Fat Leonard, although I'm pretty sure they didn't call it to his face, because of his girth, who is the centerpiece of a massive bribery scandal involving Navy officers, including Rear Admiral Gilbo. Glenn Francis has admitted to bribing Navy officials with more than $500,000 in cash and other gifts in exchange for classified information to help his company, Glenn Defense Marine Asia. Francis and his company supplied food and fuel to ships overbilled the Navy by more than $34 million that they can count on anyway. Rear Admiral Gilbo first met Francis in 1997 during a port visit to Bali, Indonesia, where Francis wooed Gilbo, another Navy officer, with hotel rooms, dinners, and services. For years, Francis footed the bill for Gilbo's late-night partying at clubs, fine dining, luxury hotels, and other activities that you can probably guess for yourselves. In exchange, Gilbo signed off on Francis's company invoices that grossly overbilled the Navy. On Wednesday, May 17th, Rear Admiral Gilbo was sentenced to 18 months in jail. 18 months in jail for millions of dollars. He wrote in a statement to the court that while PTSD is not an excuse, it did give him a desire to make self-destructive decisions. He was allowed to retire but reduced to the rank of captain. 20 current and former Navy officers have been charged thus far. 10 have pleaded guilty. The point is this. There's no doubt that combat activities certainly has an impact. No doubt we have to work to try to find the best solutions. Later today, we're going to have a conversation about Veterans Court and how we can actually make sure and find the best solutions for folks that are veterans trying to get justice. And yet, in our public role, we are responsible for making sure that we spend every penny as if it's the last scarce penny in the jar to make sure that we make them reach as far as we can. So I just thought that particular story on Armed Forces Day might be helpful for us to remember. So welcome to the committee. We have three bills today. Two I'm hoping to move, SCR 13 and SB 573 I'm hoping to move today. Representative Meek is going to share with us a little bit about Senate Bill 143 and some amendments that I know many of you have been working on. We have a informative hearing, and I want to make sure and be respectful of Justice Prawl's time. We do have a custom that if a member of the Senate or the House come in to testify, we're probably going to let them do that first, but then we'll get along with the informational hearing. So, Senator, which one would you like us?
143.
143. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 143A. Mr. Volk, please explain the bill, and then we'll have the good senator share her thoughts.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. We last heard this on April 27th. Since then, there has been a dash to amendment, best described as a gut and stuff. It replaces the prior bill very substantially. I'll try to summarize what it does. It directs the ODVA to develop and implement one or more conditional grant programs on an annual competitive basis to community colleges and public universities to expand campus veteran resource centers by concentrating grant money in the areas of the greatest need for veteran assistance programs. It limits ODVA administrative overhead to 8% of the total funds appropriated for purposes of the grant program. It restricts a grant recipient to $25,000 of grant funds to pay a campus resource coordinator salary if the grant recipient commits to matching at least 50% of the grant funds. Provides that grant recipients may not use grant funds to duplicate services provided by county and veteran services officers. The measure further directs ODVA to develop a formula for scoring grant proposals based on a maximum score of 100 points with allocation percentages on various criteria. Requires grant recipients to provide a program report to ODVA within 30 days after the end of each calendar quarter. Provides that in addition to and not in lieu of money appropriated to ODVA for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2017, ODVA may use $1.1 million out of the Veterans Services Fund established under Article 15, Section 4F of the Oregon Constitution, the recent Ballin measure. Directs ODVA to report to the Interim Legislative Assembly no later than August 31st, 2018 on implementation of the grant programs and on further steps required to expand programs during the 2019-21 biennium. Takes effect the 91st day after CND.
Okay. Senator?
Thank you, Chair Evans and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here. Senator Boquist and I brought Senate Bill, the original Senate Bill 143, to the committee, working very closely with ODV, and wanting to make sure that we got it right. As you know, a strong campus veterans program is extremely important, so I'm not going to go into that. It really helps attract and retain veterans, and it really results in increasing and retaining federal financial assistance for these veterans also. I like the original bill. I just, not more than 10 minutes ago, found out that there was a gut and stuff. I don't know, maybe you've worked with Senator Boquist or not. So I just very briefly looked at it, and I know it would have to go to conference committee if you do decide to go with the amendment. It's just a gut reaction to the amendment. It is much more prescriptive, and the bill that we passed would give the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs more discretion on how to use it. So I haven't really taken the time, haven't really talked with ODVA how this is, but I just needed to let you know that, and I haven't even talked with Representative Meek about it, but I know that it's extremely important for us to have grant programs. All in favor of that, right. And whatever the committee decides, then we'll duke it out in conference committee. Okay.
All right. And Senator, there's actually been a couple of differences between the original bill that was offered. The bill that came to us was for a study. This was actually going closer into intent of the original bill.
Right. And I preferred the original bill. Senator Boquist, and I shouldn't be speaking for him, but wanted to have the advisory committee, since we were getting so many requests of this new money, the advisory committee to give us input on all of these programs that are going to be needing money, and then we would take it from there. But I'm willing to work with you and very open. I just would like to get money to our VC, our campus veterans resource centers.
Representative Isbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, would you like some time to discuss this with our representative here?
And Senator Bocas, we would love to have that, but you know, we're down to a time crunch, mm-hmm. and so I don't want to hold it up because we can always work things out in a conference committee, too.
Okay.
So it's sort of what's the most expeditious way that you'd like to go.
We will work on that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, so for Senate Bill
you, Senator.
143, I don't see any other senators or representatives for that. So I'm going to temporarily close Senate Bill 143 Alpha. Where'd Gelser go?
Should be right back. It's next right now.
Should be right back. All right.
Well, Chair Evans, do you want me to tell you a little bit about the amendments we made?
Why don't you talk about the amendments?
Okay.
So I'm going to reopen a public hearing on 143 Alpha while we're waiting for Senator Gelser, who will be here in just a minute.
Well,
right. When she gets here, we'll open that one up. I want to let Mr. Meek talk about this. Go ahead.
Well, you asked myself and other Representative Post and Esquivel to work on some amendments that could provide a vehicle to flow grant money through the Measure 98 to community colleges and public universities to support services for veterans. And after working closely with LDVA, and I believe we found a really reasonable path forward that preserves the intent of Senate Bill 143, hopefully, as introduced, and also maintains the spirit of the engrossed version we heard testimony on. The proposed -2 amendments you have, that are on oldest right now, and we just read, are a reflection of input from ODBA. They're on oldest, right? And just want to give you an opportunity to take a look, to listen to. One of the goals with this amendment was to leverage available dollars by expanding and enhancing existing services. So that means that we are focusing on colleges and universities, public universities, that have existing campus veterans resource centers or resource coordinators that already are providing services to help veterans transition from the military life to the college life and ultimately back into the workforce. And I can take a pause right now to let Senator
keep All right. going. We're going to close Senate Bill 143A work session for the second time. And we're going to open up a public hearing on SCR 13. Mr. Volk.
Thank you, Chairman. SCR 13 recognizes Jason Westland for exemplary service in assisting an accident victim. On August 2nd, 2016...
Do you want the Senator to explain that part?
Sure.
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, for the record, my OLIS is not working, so I'm not able to pull up the bill. But also for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the State Senator for Albany and Corvallis, and I'm very pleased to bring this resolution to you. It was a real honor to carry it on the Senate floor and to have both parties participate in both the hearing process. And Mr. Westland himself was not able to be with us when we carried it on the floor of the Senate, but he was able to be there for our hearing. This is what happened in the story. It's a really great story about when Oregonians take care of each other and do the right thing just because they do. Riley was a young man, high school student, traveling just west of my district when he was engaged in a pretty horrific car accident. Jason Westland happened to witness this accident. Being an Army medic, he jumped out of his own car and kind of ran to the danger. The other party in the crash, unfortunately, was deceased. But he was able to go and talk with Riley, hold his hand, start assessing the situation when he realized that the car was catching on fire. And as you know, that is a very, very dangerous situation. He immediately knew that what he needed was a fire extinguisher, and all the people stopped along the side of the road. Many people started running from the fire, but there was an elderly gentleman that, again, ran to the danger, brought Jason fire extinguisher was able to put out the fire. At that point, Riley's condition was worsening. Jason was able to recognize that this was a very dire situation, was able to communicate with first responders to let them know they were going to need a helicopter to be able to stabilize him and get him to the hospital in Portland. He then stayed with him. He stayed with him and held his hand so that he would not be alone while he waited for responders to get there. What I also learned about Jason Westland in the hearing was just how highly he spoke of the first responders and just what a great operation that was from the folks that came that day to help Riley. Now, a lot of people would think that's where the story would stop. The medics came, they got Riley, they put him in the helicopter, everybody goes on about their day. Not Jason Westland. Jason Westland got in the car, he went to Portland, and when Riley's family got there from Central Oregon, Jason Westland, a man they'd never met, had never known, was there waiting for them and sat with them while Riley underwent surgery. He then went back and visited him, checked on him to make sure that he was recovering, gave him one of his patches from his time of service, and then continued to keep in touch with him. The other thing that he did was go back and restock his car. He was very frustrated that he did not have a fire extinguisher in his car, and he used the opportunity at the Senate Rules Committee to remind everyone of what we all need to have in our cars so that we can provide aid and assistance. So it was last fall that I actually heard from Riley's parents. Riley miraculously survived, went through a number of surgeries. He's going to graduate from high school this summer. Without Jason Westland, Riley would not be with us. Riley still has a ways to go in his recovery, but he has a new friend and had the opportunity to see what our communities can be like when people step up and do the right thing, not because they have to, not because some law tells them to, but just because they are a human being and they wouldn't want to be left alone in a situation like that. So I hope that you will move this resolution forward. Jason Westland is well deserving of this recognition, and I hope that what people can take from it is both, what do each of us do every day to look around to see those in need? What are the things that we know that can make a difference in a life and on any given day? And because I was listening to Jason Westland, do we all have the things that we need to have in our car so that we can be ready to assist in a time of emergency for someone else or for ourselves or our own family? Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Great story. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing.
Right.
If you have no questions.
Thank you so much.
We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session on SCR 13. Mr. Volk, please read the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. The senator gave a great background of this. I'll just quickly summarize. Senate Concurrent Resolution 13 recognizes Jason Westland for exemplary service to his nation, state, and community, and thanks to Mr. Westland for the example of a citizenship he has set for all Oregonians. Lastly, SCR 13 extends the Legislative Assembly's best wishes to Riley Russell for his continued recovery.
Okay.
The vote in the Senate was ayes 29, excused 1. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Okay, no fiscal, no revenue.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 13 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves SCR 13 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing no discussion, Sky, please call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. And is there a preferred somebody on this side?
She can't. Who's on the bill?
It's just
the senator, so we can.
Representative Esquivel.
We're going to have Representative Esquivel
carry the bill.
Oh, I'm here.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is like the service.
That's right. You do our best work.
You need to be
skedaddled. You want to open? You want to go to 500, and then we'll have the.
That'd be fine.
Okay, we'll be very quick. We have one more bill to do, and then we'll get to the informant. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 573. Senate Bill 573.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. Senate Bill 573 encourages reflection to honor military service members lost at war at noon on the 21st day of each month for 21 seconds. Senate Bill 573 encourages a very specific form of reflection to honor service members who died in war, pausing for 21 seconds at noon on the 21st day of every month. It is based on the patriotic symbolism of the number 21. It being the 21st century, the honor of a 21-gun salute associated with the Tomb of the Unknowns, and the sum of the numbers 1776. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. The vote in the Senate was 30 ayes.
We have a sheet of anybody who... There's nobody that wants to speak in favor of it.
Representative Post, did you want to say something about it?
No, I think it's a great bill. It should pass.
Okay.
Good job.
Okay, Representative Post thinks it's a great bill and it should pass. We have that now on the record. Anybody else want to comment? Everybody, yeah, okay. We're going to close the public hearing. See which way we're going to do on this. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 573.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 573 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 573 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Mr. Volk? Is there any fiscal or...
There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Good enough for me. Sky, call the vote.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Still excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Post is going to carry this bill.
He's got the speech for it.
All right. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go to the informational hearing. We're going to have an informational meeting. We're going to invite up Judge Prawl and Rita Rahome Myers. Come on up, please. What we're going to do, folks, is after this, then we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 143. My goal is not to move it today because I understand there's another amendment, but I also know that there's a fiscal concern I want to make sure it gets in the discussion. Yeah. Please come forward. And thank you for your patience. My goal is not to ever keep a judge waiting, especially a judge that might someday suggest my driving too fast might be a problem. Hope that you remember that in the future, that I didn't intend to keep you waiting. Please, for the record, say your name.
Chair Evans and committee members, my name is Tracy Prawl. I'm the presiding judge for Marion County Circuit Court. I'm here today in my capacity as the presiding judge of the Marion County Veterans Treatment Court. I am not here today representing the Oregon Judicial Department. With me is Rita Rehome Myers. She is our treatment court coordinator for the Veterans Court, and Joseph Glenn Anthony. He is one of our most recent graduates. First, I want to begin by thanking you for your work with veterans and appreciate the invitation to talk about our Veterans Treatment Court. I think what most of us know is that veterans work very hard in their military service, and we really expect them to come back stronger than when they entered. But the truth is that often they come back wounded physically and mentally, and oftentimes that mental injury is accompanied by drug abuse, either because they're trying to self-medicate or they are trying to push down thoughts, feelings, memories. That really leads them down a path that they may never have expected and really don't have the tools on their own to deal with. And then it oftentimes or sometimes leads them into the criminal justice system. The idea behind veterans treatment courts is to prevent their further penetration into the justice system. The idea is that they have served our country and we are there to serve them. Hoping that we can impact them and steer them in a different direction. The veterans treatment courts are really designed to bring together those services that they're entitled to through the federal VA, mental health services, drug and alcohol services, and to tie those together with really a team approach that ensures their success. So we talk to veterans, and often what they tell us is that this incident that got them involved with the law is often their wake-up call. And really what they need help, they need support to help them get on the right track. The Marion County Veterans Treatment Court operates under many of the same principles as a traditional drug court does. We have we follow those same models for an effective crime reduction program. We utilize, again, collaborative approach, a team approach. We have the judge, a treatment court coordinator. We have a probation officer on our team, the DA, a deputy DA. Actually, two deputy DAs are on our team. We have two defense attorneys on our team, and then a Veterans Justice Outreach Officer is on our team, and she helps to connect us with all the VA services. The team follows what are called the 10 key components of a veterans treatment court, also similar to the 10 key components of a drug court. We follow those 10 key components to try to provide a successful outcome for the veteran. The first step in our court process is, of course, identifying veteran defendants. This can be very difficult. This is done when veterans are in custody. The jail has an initial questionnaire, and the veteran can choose to mark the box that says they're a veteran. Frankly, that doesn't always work because many veterans don't want to self-identify. They're embarrassed that they're in custody, or they feel like their military service has gotten them there. And so they don't self-identify. If they're out of custody, it's even more difficult for us to know who they are and to connect them with our court. We have tried multiple times to talk with the defense bar, so we've done presentations to the defense bar, and the defense attorneys are now that connection, and they have come to also do something like a form when they're doing initial intake with a client. They've added a line, "Are you a veteran?" hoping to then ensure that those veterans know that they have an option. They may be eligible for the Veterans Treatment Court. If they're a veteran identified as a veteran and we know it, then we send that information to the district attorney, and the district attorney assigned to our team will review the case file to determine whether it is a crime eligible for the Veterans Treatment Court. We do not allow ballot measure 11 crimes, and we do not allow sex offense crimes in our court. But we do try to work collaboratively with the district attorney's office. They really they are the first step in saying whether or not this particular crime is a crime that they'll allow to come into the Veterans Treatment Court. Sometimes there are victim issues. If it's something where there's a lot of fear or a lot of history, there are some cases that we won't take on that basis as well. But if the district attorney identifies them as eligible, an eligible crime, then the case is turned over to our Veterans Treatment Court coordinator, and she reviews the case to determine whether or not the veteran qualifies for our court. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Rita, and she can quickly talk to you about our entry criteria.
So the entry criteria has kind of evolved over the last 3 years since we've been doing this court. The court officially started in 2012 as a docket, and then we were able to garner some funding to actually bring it to a full court program in 2013. And the process for entry has been an ongoing evolve from that. So we have gone from looking at just accepting people with combat experience to opening it up to every veteran in our area. And I think it was especially crucial because we have the National Guard here locally, and we've had instances where we needed to look at having those participants be able to enter our court without having been overseas somewhere. So once I get their DD-214, which is their release paperwork, I would then talk with our VJO up in Portland, and we determine whether or not they meet the criteria. And the criteria is pretty broad. Our criteria is that they had to have active duty in any of the services, or they also can be service connected by a disability. And then we also work with the reserves and National Guards if they've completed basic military training and have honorable conditions.
Can I ask a brief question? When you say active duty, mm-hmm. one of the tricks the Pentagon has been recently doing is bringing people on Title 32 orders, mm-hmm. which aren't necessarily seen as Title 10 mm-hmm. for purposes of other types of benefits. For your distinction, if somebody is called up under Title 32 training, but they're actually doing hurricane support or something like that, how do you identify them in your system?
I think that's how we kind of work with our VJO also, because it has to, in order for us to offer our services in our court, we have to be able to offer them either VA health care benefits, which is the treatment programming, or we have to be able to offer something local. So we've been able to, case by case, we actually look at those and we determine whether or not something that's happened in their service has that affected and has that brought them to the place that they are and coming into our court. So I would answer that question more broadly and say that it would be a case by case, but most likely we would probably bring somebody in with that.
Okay. Thank mm-hmm. you.
I'm sorry, did I get off track? I'm more of a script person, I am sorry. So once we determine their eligibility, then I sit down and I talk with them. We do a kind of an orientation. We have them come and watch one of our hearings. One of the biggest barriers, I think, is just like Judge Prawl has said, that and Joseph may also agree with this, is that many veterans don't want to be recognized as a veteran that has criminal justice activity now. And so in order to try to, we don't want to glorify our program in a way that brings them unwanted attention. So I want them to come and I want them to listen to how we're running our court, and I want them to see if that's something that they're willing to participate in. And once they do that, then we go through everything in our manual and our policies and procedures. And they have to agree that they're going to come into our program with the idea of wanting and willing to accept that change factor. And so from there, I think this is one of the biggest points I really want to make, is that one of the barriers that we are noticing is a defendant can come into our program and I go through all of these, you know, these conditions and the requirements of our program, and it's pretty intensive, and they may have an attorney who is looking out for their best interest and saying, hey, you know, maybe you should just take this probation sentence offer and be done with it. You won't have as many requirements. However, what I really find, and I'm passionate about that, is that most of these people deeply need some assistance, and we need to be able to give them a wraparound, comprehensive way of treating the underlying problem so they don't return to our criminal justice system. And the probation route is not that route. This program is what we need to help them get those services quickly and get them into a treatment center or get them hooked up with a counselor, someone that they need to talk with, to get those issues contained so that they can be successful. I would like to give you just a few statistics. I finished out our recent grant at the end of 2016, and when I was going through all of our reporting, I found that since we opened the program in 2013, we've served a total of 68 participants in this area, 30 of which have graduated from our program. We've terminated 15 of those participants, and then currently we're somewhere between, and this is a constant, so it's somewhere between 25, 27. At that time, this was a 27 in our program that we would see on a fairly weekly basis. Of the 30 graduates that we've had, though, and this is where I get really excited, only one had committed another crime. And out of the 15 that were actually terminated from our program, I was able to, I do many reports and I do statistics on them, and I found that 9 of those had additional criminal involvement, but 2 of which still remain connected to our program. In fact, the termination of our program was what their moment of reality, when it hit them and they noticed, man, this is it. If I got terminated from this program, I need to do something. And they've become clean, they're sober, and they've remained that way. So even our failures, so to speak, are successes in my book. I do want to say one of the things that I'm very most proud of recently is that we've had our first female graduate. That has been an ongoing issue for us, to have any of the females make it through the program. We've had many, many failures, unfortunately, and we're working desperately to try to figure out what that is. There's many, there's deep reasonings that they just can't seem to make it through the program, but this one did, and she's actually moving on and going to OSU. Now that she has graduated our program. And kind of with that, I would like to introduce Joseph Glenn Anthony, who is absolutely one of our most recent graduates and kindly agreed to come here at the very last minute. And he will explain his story, maybe give you some insights on his experience here.
Welcome.
Chair Evans, thank you.
When I met people, other veterans in the court, what I say to them is, don't pass this one up. Yeah, I found myself with my back against the wall and nobody around me. And when I got here, I found people who were able to help me. I go to school now at George Fox University, and I'm a pre-nurse. That's where I'm heading, and I work my butt off. And I'm willing to put in the work. I've never had that problem. I'll work, but I just had a situation where I had no. I was getting it from all directions and no support. And
could you just? We have to get this on the record. Could you give your name and just what town you live in?
Joseph Glen Anthony. I live here in Salem now.
Salem. Okay, good. So keep going. So you're going to school to be a nurse.
Going to school to be a nurse. And it just I didn't have resources. I didn't have people. Didn't have somebody to say, hey, you could do this. You could do this. These are some options. Just somebody to bounce some ideas off of. And I like the alcohol. That was my way out. That was my burn down. And it was what it was. And it got me where I'm at now. And today I can find a way for most of the things in my life to be grateful. I'm going in the right direction. But that when I talk to people who, kind of, the last person I saw, he had some kind of funny situation and it didn't work. He had to get 8 hours of community service or something like that. And I'm just the best thing you can do is let this stuff roll off your back as fast as you can. Put in your 8 hours, be done with it, move on. This is, you got people helping you. This is your best chance. This is your chance to turn this thing around and.
And how many years were you in the Marine Corps?
My time in the Corps was short. I joined and was injured in boot camp. A little bit of coolness about it. I broke my arms the second day I was there. But I trained for 6 weeks until we figured it out. So
6 weeks on a broken arm, yeah. That's
broken arms, too. Right.
Two broken arms. Right. All right.
Well. But it was what it was. I joined, I went, and that's how it went.
Now you're here.
And now I'm here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Mr. Lyman.
Thank you. Judge, a couple questions. So are there other programs like this in the state, or is this...
There are. It's my understanding, Klamath, I think, was one of our first veterans treatment courts. They started in 2010. Lane has a veterans court docket. Columbia and Malheur have small veterans dockets. Multnomah recently started a veterans court. And I believe the Columbia, they're more like parts of the criminal docket than a full treatment court. But they're all trying to move that way. So Klamath is kind of our flagship, and we're all following behind.
And if I might,
yes, sir. Sure.
And so, why couldn't the system that was in place have served? I'm trying to understand. And I think it's a great program. Don't get me wrong, but I'm trying to understand the justice system we had before. It didn't work. It couldn't work. Or what was the?
So I think one of the issues is, the veteran defendants in Marion County are certainly eligible for VA services, the health care services, they have really a hard time accessing them when they're in the throes of addiction or a mental health crisis. And so the idea behind the treatment court is that they come to court regularly. In a regular criminal case, I may see the defendant one time, yeah, the day that I've sentenced them, and then maybe one more time if they violate their probation. I don't know their names. I don't recognize their faces. They probably don't even know my name. But in treatment court, I see every defendant monthly, at least 2 to 3 times a month, and get to know them. I don't know that it's so much the judge that's the important piece as it is the full team. All the team members are there during every court appearance, so the participants see that we're all there. We're all there to support them. Even when giving a sanction, I tell them, this is your sanction. We're right here beside you to make sure you're able to do your sanction. Generally, we sanction with community service or essays. Sometimes we try not to use jail as a sanction unless they commit a new crime. Then they're going to have a jail sanction. But really, it is to ensure that they're able to access the services that they're entitled to. Marion County has, while we sit at the seat of the state, we do not have a justice outreach, a veterans justice outreach officer. So because we have one on our team, it makes it easier for the veterans to access those services.
If I could just to confirm, in some states when the veterans court program was developing, several things were tried in different places, and I'm curious which ones are in place here. One was not just the judge and parole probation and potentially social workers or ODVA, but also potential employers, other folks that help for the next steps after the sanctions are complete, how to build life and move forward, which isn't necessarily part of the traditional piece. Is that part and parcel of what you're doing here still, or is that?
Right. Well, one of the goals is to either have them working in school, or if they're disabled, to have them in some sort of a community service, a volunteer type of position when they leave our court. So that's what we're working on in the last phase, is making sure they're connected.
And then the vet-to-vet accountability piece? In some states, they talked about the value of the vet-to-vet accountability, where they would have veterans a part of the organization that were not offenders, but basically vets that could tell everybody else whether the story was good, bad, or indifferent, and basically build mentor relationships. Right. I don't know if that's...
Every single one of our participants has a mentor, and they are veterans.
Okay.
And they are volunteer.
They're volunteer, and they come to meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So just one more question. So you have other duties besides this, and I'm just trying to understand from a time standpoint, because I know the courts in many cases have a lot of work.
Right.
So I'm trying to understand how this worked,
right,
how this fits into your other...
We do veterans treatment court three Thursdays a month.
Okay.
So the first, second, and fourth Thursday, generally, it's a half a day. So it's a day and a half a month.
Did you set aside?
Blanketly, a day and a half a month of my time. Plus, right now, a lot more time because we're working on the budget and grants and making sure that the court is funded. And I would say that that's one of the issues that we have, is how all of our treatment courts are funded, frankly, is an issue. A lot of them, it's kind of a hodgepodge of different grants, and the CJC controls the funding mm-hmm. to us, and they are looking at maybe even a 50% cut in their budget, which significantly affects our ability to provide services in our court.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And after hearing the story about the Marine boot camp, I was going to make a joke about Air Force, but I'll refrain. Because
if I had a soul left, it would hurt.
I just don't think you would have survived the boot camp like this man did, Air Force. I actually have a couple questions for you, Rita. I was jotting some notes down. You said 2012 is when this started. Is that sound right? Okay. Judge Day helped start the program, if I remember right, back in 2012, and was significant in writing that first grant from the federal government, and was a big proponent of the program. In your opinion, has it changed much since he presided?
You're putting me on the spot here. So I think that any program, when it's new, is going to go through transformations. And I think that... you can have we are in a transitional period where we have looked at how it was begun and the ideas that were put into place in that time frame, and then when we looked through the growth or lack of growth, we had to stop and kind of refigure why we weren't doing what we were doing, and to the best of what we call the fidelities of the standards of the treatment court. And so we have reworked the program, and we've allowed more participants to enter the program. But I would say that undoubtedly everybody that is on our team is still just as passionate about their role on the team. And I do not have a military background myself. My father was Korean War. that's the only thing that I have that would bring me to this position, other than my passion for wanting to help individuals that desperately deserve that help. And I truly believe that this is a program that we need to keep supporting and keep going, because even though he's nervous, they're hurting, you know, they're hurting, and we need to be able to offer something to them, and that's what this program has allowed us to do in a manner that isn't just push them through the system. We are giving them back their lives. Joseph's a perfect example of that. He's excelled. I've got several others I could give you long stories on, but it'll go too long. So it works. This program works, and I'm proud to be part of this program.
Thank you. Yeah, and just one quick, you talked about the funding, and I'm concerned because I want to make sure the funding is taken care of. And with that in mind, the original grant had some funding for an assessor, and my understanding was that Elon Lambert was the assessor of the first year. Did she ever file a report as an assessor?
So the way the original grant was written had to be reworked several different times because there was conflict. Elon was the coordinator as well as the person that was assessing the program. And that didn't, I don't know, to you, it didn't work. So what we did is we actually hired someone, Thomas O'Connor, as a private outside evaluator. And he's the one that really kind of helped us look at the program and say, you know, this isn't working. You really need to put more effort into this part of the program. And that's what we did. When we sat down and we reworked the program, it was because of his suggestions and his ideas to get the program back on track.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Taking on a little bit different track, we have a bill somewhere in the system. I don't know where it's at. I think it actually might have made its way here to the House side. And it's a you know, kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval type document for folks who have come out of the justice system, have met sort of the not above and beyond sort of the conditions of just probation, parole, but actually, you know, have really there's some criteria in there to get that. And you had mentioned that you're interested in the nursing field, and I have served on our healthcare committee in long time ago, before I got kicked off of it.
not by me.
Not by you. I rotate through a lot of committees. But one of the things, particularly in healthcare fields, is there are very few healthcare fields. As we're talking about, where do you have people go back and do those family wage jobs, skill type based jobs, where a conviction of some type, misdemeanor or felony, is going to potentially preclude you from licensure. Oregon is one of the worst states in the nation for these kind of high threshold licensure. There are some good reasons for license, bill insurance and things that others require, but in terms of who can get them and how you access them, it's a clear problem to me. So if you get your nursing degree and butt up against the license board for the nurses board and they say, oh, you have a conviction, how can you help intervene to go then and be that sort of advocate outside of something that maybe your jurisdiction of just the regular court system, but to really help make sure we get people across that finish line, because it could be an intervention that's needed with a landlord. It could be an intervention that's needed with a job, state agency. And to me, I think that's sort of that missing link, is then who becomes that bridge person to go, like the good housekeeping seal of approval is the best way I know how to describe it, but just say, you know, this person has really done what they need to do, and you need to move past the conviction. And so what does your veterans court do to address those issues?
With the veterans approval or their release of information, really, we are allowed to write letters on behalf of the veterans. So we let the employer, we let the landlord know, I let other courts know. So I've written letters to other judges when veterans have multiple jurisdictions that they're involved with. And so I'm able to write them and tell them what their status is in our court. Otherwise, the information is confidential because it's a treatment court. But if the veteran allows it, usually it's the veteran wants it, wants me to write a letter on their behalf. So I've written many letters to employers, landlords, possible landlords, and the DMV, several letters to DMV. Beyond that, one of the goals of our court is for someone to come out conviction-free, so some of our defendants are offered up front that if you complete the program, your case will be dismissed. Others are really avoiding prison sentences. We have several who are, if you do this program, then you won't go to prison today. And some are, if it's a felony, we'll reduce it to a misdemeanor. That's really where most of ours fall. If it's a felony, it's reduced to a misdemeanor, so that is very helpful. But some, like even the medical field, is just a conviction, even if it's a misdemeanor, can be harmful to their or a barrier to their ability to get that job. So those are things where I can certainly write a letter to say that they successfully completed our program and outline what our program entails so that they can see that this person did something onerous, but I think they would be limited by some licensure issues. There's not much I can do beyond writing the letter.
Right. So just to follow up on that, is there a conversation about some type of vehicle that, after successful completion, could be used to provide a temporary or some type of specialized affirmative allowance in terms of a background check that basically says this is...
That may be part of the bill she was referring to. There's like a certificate.
So there's a couple bills, Mr. Chair.
But that doesn't relate to the veterans program specifically.
It doesn't. It relates across the board. So there's this sort of certificate of good standing type for people who have really met those criteria that you can then take that. And it's sort of like something with the state seal on it that says, you know, we have said that this individual is really ready to move on in life. Right. And something that... jobs and landlords and whoever can look at that and go, okay, this has meaning. So that's one bill. The other bill, which didn't move out of committee this year, which kind of stresses me out a little bit, but and we'll keep bringing it back, but some of our boards, I'll just be frank, are they see a background check and pops up, and their immediate default is, we're not going to give that person a license. And so there's another bill that I would love to try to do in a subsequent session because it's dead this year, but that would actually give the court the ability to then kind of intervene and say, we're going to override the board. If this person, you know, basically granting the privilege of saying that that a state agency could not use that conviction as part of a licensure anymore and basically wipe the slate clean a different way.
Okay.
And some of the state agencies don't want to be overridden that way, but there's a bill because there's a problem with getting license for people who have conviction. And when we have double the amount of licenses that Washington State requires across all professions in this state,
we want to be best at something.
So there is a different way to handle that. It's a little less, you know, like I said, a little harder, heavier lift, but it actually was addressing both kind of superseding fees on DMV and also the licensure piece.
During the interim in your spare time, Judge, we may actually ask for a conversation about what's the appropriate vehicle so that judge to judge.
Right.
So that courts, that there's a unified approach as opposed to just parts. But thank you very much for that. Thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. Representative Lucy had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several, actually. First of all, thank you for your testimony today. It was really helpful to understand the Veterans Court. Do you hear domestic violence cases?
We do.
Okay. The reason I asked that question is a few years ago, before I retired and before the Veterans Court, we had occasion to deal with a domestic violence situation with a returned veteran from Iraq. And after he was taken into custody, talking to his wife, she was at wit's end because she couldn't find counseling, treatment, or anything else specific for veterans. And so my question is, do you have access now to counseling and treatment programs that are specific to veterans' needs, not only the veterans, but their families?
Right. That's another problem for us in Marion County is that we don't have any treatment in Marion County. Yeah. So that's another access problem. Again, when they're in the throes of their addiction or a mental health issue or a PTSD in a domestic violence type of situation, they can't access those services on their own. They're just not capable in the moment. The nearest PTSD treatment for veterans that's paid by the VA is in Roseburg. The only dual diagnosis centers in Oregon are Roseburg and White City. So folks in Salem or Marion County would have a really hard time getting there, knowing what to do, how to access it. So our team is able to, we get them there. We have some priority, I would say, by having the VJO on our team. The other facilities that we utilize for drug and alcohol are in Vancouver and Walla Walla. So again, if you try to think about how is the veteran in jail going to access those services on their own when they don't even want to admit they're a veteran? So I think this court is really crucial to the veterans in those situations. Our probation officer is actually also the domestic violence probation officer from Marion County, one of them. And so he has a lot of training how to handle domestic violence. And sometimes those are the issues that I was saying, that if the victim feels extreme fear, if there's a really long history, we may not take them. But what we have found is that the veterans that have domestic violence issues that come into our court, it's the spouse or the partner that wants them in our court. They care about them. They know what their experience in the military has done to them. They know what they were like before, and they're totally different now, and they want them in the court. They want them to get better.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned a couple of services. Are there other treatment services, counseling services, or whatever that you feel there's a gap right now in providing for specific for veterans?
Can I answer that? Mm-hmm. So that is an ongoing problem. We do have a Salem Veterans Center, a vet center here. However, in order to access the vet center, you have to have been a combat vet. So some of our participants cannot go to them and seek out their counseling services unless they have the right criteria. Locally, we do have the outreach center from the Portland VA, and that offers extended care, aftercare, after they've completed a treatment, an inpatient treatment program through one of those centers that the judge just explained. However, they are very limited in their services as well, so they can see our participants, you know, once a week, but maybe not as intensely as they need. And one of the barriers that we are having is the vet center that does offer the counseling. I don't know if they're going through some. We used to have a member on our team, and they've now pulled that back, and they don't participate with our team anymore. I think because they're really short-staffed. And so even for the participants that qualify to go to the vet center for counseling, they can get an appointment maybe once a month or once every 2 months. And these are gentlemen or females that need that service at least twice a month at a minimum. So that is another area that we are we struggle with, and we're trying to forge relationships with local partners to try to help kind of close that gap that we have.
And one final question, Mr. Yep. Sure. You mentioned justice outreach officer. Can you explain what that is and what kind of what would their duties be?
Yeah, so the VA created, and I'm not sure of the date, so I'm not going to quote the date, but they created a specialized officer role that is called a Veterans Justice Outreach. And that person's sole duties are to reach out to any criminally involved veteran. So whether it be in the jail or they have a crime that they are dealing with, but they also have an underlying treatment issue, that VJO is supposed to be able to reach out and help them get connected with any services that they could get them into the healthcare, VA healthcare, to take care of. Frequently, we have in our region, and it's based out of the Portland VA, they have three VJOs assigned to Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon. They have to cover all of those counties in that area. So those three people are you know, stretched quite thin, and they try their best to do the outreach in the jails. But one of the reasons that this court is even more important is that we can get those people in, and then she can reach, or one of them can reach in and get them quickly involved into the treatment rather than letting them languish for a while. So the Veteran Justice Outreach person is the liaison between the healthcare system and the court system. So she sits. We have one, and she comes and she sits on our team. She's, you know, very active, and she gives us the reports from treatment, from their health, homelessness updates, anything of that nature that the VA is working on with that person.
When somebody's in custody, she also does a reach-in. So we have a kiosk, a video kiosk in the jail, and she's in Portland, and she talks to them and does an initial assessment to make sure that they're eligible for the VA services.
Thank you.
Okay.
A little bit to piggyback off your question, there is a bill in Senate rules, Senate Bill 1050. It's parked there and stuck, and the goal is to have some mental health hospital treatment for veterans. But one facility up in Washington County, Cedar Hills Hospital, do you have folks that you are able to refer there as part of?
Yeah, we don't refer them, but we refer them. The VJO will then talk to the VA healthcare, and if they do not have ready-made beds, which very, very rarely they do, they will then contract out to Cedar Hills. And so we've had several participants go to the Cedar Hills program as well.
And I'm just hopeful maybe our committee can help pry Senate Bill 1054 out of Senate rules. I've got to run to a meeting, but I want to thank you for your military service, and thank you for being here today to tell your story.
Okay, so just two quick things, and then a big thank you. One, after the committee hearing at another time, I'd like to do a follow-up because I want to confirm about the rules that you've been told about the vet center and access, because I've sent people there that weren't combat vets and they got help. So I'm confused about that. The second piece is in terms of other services that maybe other courts may have that we need here, certainly not opposed to helping communicate with Marion County commissioners that maybe they can pony up more since they currently are not supporting a VSO for the county. Maybe if they're watching, they could be on the hook to help support this. So, and then the last thing, just a big thank you for number one, for coming. Thank you for coming. And number two, I know that over the last several years, it's not exactly been an easy environment in the Marion County Vet Court. But I know from folks who have been through the process that some of the changes that you have put into place have actually been very well received, and that some of the traditions that had been established at the beginning, changing those, I think, open up a lot of conversations that otherwise wouldn't have happened. So thank you for your patience and your navigation on that. If you have any other questions or comments you'd like us to consider, other than that, we're going to let you have the rest of your afternoon, if that's all right.
Thank you again. We were honored to be asked. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to close the informational hearing. Thank you very much. We're going to reopen for the third time Senate Bill 143 Alpha, a public hearing. And Mr. Representative Meek, please continue telling us about the amendment status. And the
Thank
amendment
you.
On the way.
Chair Evans. Okay, so it was important that for the group that institutions not duplicate services provided at the county level through the VSOs. So we want to make sure it's through the community colleges. And then after evaluating the 8 community colleges and 6 universities, we determined that grant awards of up to $100,000 be distributed, you know, they have to go through a process, but potentially be distributed to community colleges and public universities based on the greatest need and ability for the to meet the grant program's objectives and for the best use of our limited resources. We also acknowledge that ODVA will need to allocate funds, you know, to manage the grant process and the administration of that. And so it's our intent that for a limited duration, that the position that they have allow for in a limited position to augment the existing position to establish and administer the program, and that the work group felt that this was fiscally responsible in a constrained budget year. We have requested the additional changes be reflected in the Dash 3 amendment that we have discussed to address the concerns raised by the ODVA and maintain the spirit of the Senate's engrossed version. So we have to hopefully come to a conclusion and get to a resolution with that. Section 6 of the Dash 2 was meant to provide guidelines for grant awards, and the department has asked that we allow them to implement these by rule instead. So we're
good. That was accepted as a change?
Yes. Is that correct? Yes. Okay.
So what I think is going on here, and just hopefully as we move forward and try to get a bill that is close enough that perhaps a concurrence might happen. The bill that came to us was directing a study. We're trying to continue the idea of a study, but also in the near term provide a vehicle to get more money out to the folks that are actually trying to do this. And the discussion, as I understand it, is the limited duration role that DAS suggested in terms of pricing versus more of a full-time position for the agency. And I know in previous conversations with Representative Parrish and some others, a concern and a sensitivity toward how many new staff people were buying with the lottery versus money going out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that it's not a perfect answer, but we're trying to find the best balance given the circumstances. As we get these Dash 3, we're going to schedule the bill, whatever time we need to schedule the bill so we meet the requirements that want to move it forward. But I want everybody involved to know we're not trying to say ODVA can't have the staff you want, but trying to make sure that the staffing up of ODVA is at the same time with getting more money out the doors to the folks that are actually on the ground providing the services. And though the director and I in the past have struggled about the idea of state and county VSOs, he actually convinced me on the county VSO thing and making sure that there's more flexibility at the local level, which is what I think we're trying to do with this. So as soon as we can get that language together, let's get it out again so we can have one more conversation so we can move it forward.
The Dash 3 does include the advisory committee and the study. So that kind of brings it back into compliance or hopefully in a concurrent type of situation.
Well, it gives us a better idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
So thank you.
I just want to thank you and all the folks that were working on it. And I know staff was involved, and I know Cameron was there. I wasn't able to be at the meeting. And please thank Lori for her input. I think we got 80% of what she wanted, not 100, but 80%, hopefully. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a good bill.
Yeah.
So any other comments? Public hearing is open. Anybody want to make comments from the audience? Going once. Gus is giving me the stern look. No. All right. I'm going to close with the hearing on Senate Bill 143 Alpha. Any other business before the committee today? Seeing none. Next week, we will be having committee on Tuesday. On Thursday, if we have committee, it will be after or at the 1186th mobilization ceremony. 1186th military police are being mobilized for service overseas. I think there's 29 members of the unit going, and I'd like to make sure that our committee is showing support for that. So if we have any business, if the Speaker's office directs us to do some other business, we'll figure it out around that schedule. I want to make sure we're there if we can be. Okay? All right. Have a great weekend. Thank you. We're closed.
Chief Chair.
Mr. Smith.
Chief Chair.
Mr. Smith. Have a great weekend. Thank you. We're